Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I am your co-host, Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stasha Okaski. Or someone close to
that. I wondered if you remembered.
I was wondering, I was a different way to introduce it. Was it a little different introduction?
Okay, sorry.
I said, no, it's all right. And so it made me pause. Because I thought you were going to follow it up. There was a little
I will. Pause. Today is Monday, March 18th. And somebody told me that it's already spring, which confused
no,
me.
No. That's tomorrow.
Okay. That's good.
I think I saw it was Tuesday. However, yeah, who knows? Right. You know, they keep changing that. I forgot. The calendar keeps changing. The world works fine. It's the calendar that doesn't.
If humans would just get out of it.
That's, you know, it is incredible the number, you know. I don't know if I mentioned this last week or week before or at all, but someone's trying, there's some group trying to get rid of leap year.
Yep.
You know, which is so crazy because it has, it was fixed 2,000 years ago or more, you know, by one of the Caesars. That's where it started. And it made sense then. And it still makes sense to real people.
But it interferes with commerce.
Well, it's, you know, the simple answer is to change February 29th to no day.
We've talked about this.
Oh, okay. Good. I thought so. I'm wondering.
Let me thank Andy Offit Irwin for opening the show today with Tarry Here. We do appreciate you, Andy.
Oh, yeah.
And Andy, did I say our theme today is funny stories? Because that is our theme today.
Yeah.
Are you going to tell us about Speak Story Series?
Oh, boy. Speak Story Series coming up in just a couple of weeks is Antonio Roja. And boy, if anyone out there listening has never heard Antonio Roja, you should circle the second Tuesday of April that's coming up and make sure you listen or come to Speak Story Series in Shepherdstown, second Tuesday at the Community Center, 7:30 p.m. Or tune in to Zoom. Go on www.speakstoryseries.com and sign up for that. Because Antonio Roja is spellbinding. I had seen him at a place down in Tennessee. And then I saw him at Beaver Tales.
I don't know Beaver Tales.
Beaver Tales in Beaver, Pennsylvania. I went there to see him and, goodness, my brain is going bad today on names. Marsha Wong. And somebody else was a friend of ours that was there. And I realized, Beaver, Pennsylvania is not that far away. So we drove up to it. And their Beaver Tales are held in the park where the performers are in a small pagoda-like that it has no real walls. They have a curtain that can go around it in case of weather. But it was just delightful. It was delightful because the storyteller stands in the main opening of that, like four steps up to it, they're higher than the audience, sitting on chairs in the grass, and it was just delightful. And we had such fun seeing it. And he told some tales, and I was just riveted. You know, at one point, I almost fell out of my chair because I was leaning forward so much, and I realized I was really unbalanced. I had to catch myself on the chair in front of me.
So I've been there to see that.
Boy, oh yeah, to see me fall out of the chair. Well, sometime we'll have to make an arrangement for me to do that, just so I can amuse you. You know, I always like to do things so that you are happy.
Well, I have some. Oh, did you give the website for Speak?
I did.
See, I'm just
speakstoryseries.com. Yeah, well, that's okay.
Well, here's where my mind was. I want to give these little one-liner stories to our listeners.
Okay.
My daughter's friend, I had a phone conversation with him the other day, and we were talking about friendships, and he said, I don't have a girlfriend. I just know a girl who would get really mad if she heard me say that. I laughed for about 10 minutes.
So he's not sure whether he has a girlfriend or not.
Apparently.
Or if he ever did.
Okay, how about this one? I'm taking a risk with this one. Why don't visually impaired people like to skydive? Because it scares the hell out of the dog.
I like that.
I had the same 3-second pause you did.
I think that's a good one. I was trying to imagine. Oh, yeah, that dog would. He'd been kicking and screaming and barking.
Okay. Honesty is the best policy. But insanity is a better defense.
Yeah. Oh, can you hold on a second or keep going?
I can keep talking to you even if you're not there, you know.
You were back.
Our listeners certainly wouldn't know if you weren't there. Okay, here's another. My mind works like lightning. One brilliant flash and it's gone. When I read about the evils of sugar, I gave up reading. Okay. How about wise men talk because they have something to say. Fools talk because they have to say something. All right. On that note, Stash, I think I should switch gears, and I'm going to read an article from one of my favorite humorists.
I'm back.
I've moved on, Stash, and I'm going to read an article from one of my favorite humorists as soon as I find it. Gene Weingarten.
Okay.
Okay. Well, Gene is retired from the Washington Post, I believe. He's not writing his humor articles anymore. And of course, there's no more Washington Post magazines, which is where he used to have his columns. But I saved a lot of them, and I go back and read them and chuckle to myself. Okay, this is from May 14th, 2017, from Gene Weingarten. This is a column about being a columnist and being a father and being an idiot. Not necessarily in that order. One recent Sunday, I was 2 days late in writing my column and was still failing to arrange words together into a product that resembled something my editor, Tom the Butcher, would at least have called bad. Bad is negotiable. It's the beginning of a process. At that moment, though, my column was still not within editor shouting distance of bad, which is when the phone rang. It was my daughter, Molly. Okay, Dad, you didn't actually, and I'm not accusing you of this because it would be too stupid. You didn't by any chance, for some reason, flush cat litter down my toilet, right? Background. Molly is pregnant. Her husband is out of town. She is also a veterinarian, so she understands quite well that pregnant women are not supposed to handle cat feces because it can contain a parasite that causes toxoplasmosis, which is not good for babies. There are special moments in a man's life when he realizes he has been placed on earth for a reason. In my case, I understood that after 35 years of erratic, semi-competent parenting, I had been called upon to utilize my skills and wits and instincts to be a good dad. I have been tasked with a mission. So I have been going over to Molly's house once a day to scoop poopy out of a litter box and put it in a bag, which I then put into a garbage pail in the backyard. I don't want to brag, but let's just say I have heroically risen to the occasion. Or apparently not. Molly's question lingered in the air. I said into the phone. I sort of maybe did. See, there was only this one single item that I fished out of the cat box this one day, and the basement toilet was closer than the nearest plastic bag. And really, when you think of it, one of the first lessons you learn in life, even before you learn to read, is that poopy goes in toilets. So I figured, I think you need to come over here, Dad. And that is when I learned, for the first time, what happens when you flush even a little incidental bit of cat litter down a toilet, which is apparently why cat litter boxes say in big capital letters, "Do not flush." Cat litter is a preternaturally absorptive substance, apparently designed to expand to roughly 60,000 times its original volume in some horrible malignant process, like cancer, only worse. Molly's toilet resembled one of those baking soda and vinegar volcanoes the dumb kids in middle school made every year for science fairs. What had seemed to me at the time to be about a tablespoon of cat litter had swollen into a throbbing gel the size of a bowling ball that no amount of plunge flushing would get rid of. It resisted scooping efforts, dancing away like mercury. Eventually, I realized the most effective way to attack it was with my bare hands. So that's what I was doing on my knees in front of a toilet. Seeing this, Molly pointed out that rubber gloves were available and should be an option. And very gently, with love and pain in her eyes, she asked, "Do you have any common sense at all?" "Not much, Mal. But I do have two things, a complete lack of shame and a column."
That's good.
Fine garden.
That's good. I love it when people can exaggerate a little thing into a disaster like that.
Good. Especially when he's defending himself. He just gets all blustery and flustery. And he's almost always in the wrong.
Right, yeah.
But it's so amusing.
And that was his daughter, right?
Yes, yes.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. Yeah. You know, I have two daughters, and my oldest daughter has been as a younger person, not anymore so much because she's in her 50s, but when she was a young girl, she's every once in a while would say something to me like, sometimes I wonder why they let you be a teacher. And you know, why I always think that was funny is because there were times when she would come to me and say, Dad, I really need some help with this. Very rarely. I always have talked about her. My oldest daughter, Megan, is, I always think of her as the brightest, most intelligent human being I've ever met. She's very sharp, graduated first in her class all the way from grade school through college, and just a really very intelligent person. But there's that saying, she suffered no fools. She had a terrible time with things that really bothered her, and did things that I thought were dangerous at times. When she was in college, she went to the football dorm and tore down all the porno girly stuff that was on the bulletin boards on their two-floor dormitory on different bulletin boards. And didn't make any bones about it. Did it boldly, went in, it was a boys' dorm. And a friend of mine told me about it. And when I found out and I talked to her about it, she said, what were they going to do? I said, never mind. Because she had that righteous feeling that what she was doing was a good thing. And, so I like that story, especially because it was the daughter's cat. So you got to be careful of those children who are smart.
Yeah, father-daughter stories can be very interesting. I had a father. There were times where we just didn't understand each other.
Oh, well, and I think father-daughter relationships are difficult, you know. Once I took my younger daughter to the hospital when we were on a vacation to Ocean City because she fell on her bike just as her mother and I were driving away to go to dinner. And she was about 10, I guess. So I rushed her to a local emergency place, not at Ocean City exactly, but a few miles from Ocean City. I went in and the doctor was very nice and everything. It was an evening and at one point, he said to my daughter, excuse me, dear, I'll be with you in a minute. I need to check on your father. I think he's going to pass out. I was watching him work on her knee, which had been kind of busted open, and he was doing some stitching. And I said, I'm okay. And he said, you look awful. He said, here. He came over and put his hand on my shoulder and he gave me a glass of water. And he said, why don't you just sit back and quit watching what we're doing? He said, I think it's really upsetting. I thought I was fine, and it probably was, but I know I was worried about my baby.
Yep.
He wasn't crying or anything. I was the one that was upset.
Okay. Well, you're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stasz Wielkowski.
And do you have a story?
I think I do. And this is one of the stories. And I have to say up front, one of the worst things you could possibly do, and this happens a lot, people will say, this is the funniest thing I've ever heard. And they'll tell you something. And, you know, I've had people say that in meetings, and there is not the person, there is not even a snicker when they finish. and I think that's almost, that is what you'd call, that's a killer of an introduction.
Yes.
You know? You should have never started. This is the best story I've ever heard. Or, you know, this is the funniest thing I've ever heard. And so I learned early on in my storytelling, try not to preface your storytelling with some great exclamatory statement, because it might, you know, wind up being egg on your face. So, and here's this is one of the stories that I have actually been in storytelling places where somebody said, somehow someone either in the audience or else, because the guy was getting up ready to tell a story, and somebody said, oh, he's going to tell old Dry Fly. This is so great. This is wonderful. You know, and, but I'm going to do this story, Old Dry Fry, because
I'm ready.
I don't know. Have you ever heard this story?
No.
Oh, what's supposedly legendary. I've heard it many times. I've heard it at Jonesboro, and I've heard it in, I heard it in Arkansas, I heard it in Pittsburgh. So I you know, and I've heard different versions of it. And so here we go. One time there was an old man named Dry Fry. He was a preacher, but all he preached for was revival collections and all the fried chicken he could eat. And one time he stayed for supper and he was eating fried chicken so fast he got a chicken bone stuck in his throat, choked him to death. Well, the man in the house, he was scared. Law me, he says, they'll find old Dry Fry here and they'll hang me for murder and sure. So he took old Dry Fry to a house down the road a piece and propped him up against the door. Somebody went to go out the door directly. Old Dry Fry fell in the house. Oh, Lord me, says the man of the house. It's old Dry Fry. Everybody knew old Dry Fry. We got to shed him out of here quick or we're liable to be hung for murder. So he took old Dry Fry and propped him up in the brush side of the road. And way up in the night, some men come along, thought it was a highway robber laying for him. So they chunked rocks at him, knocked him down. And when they seen who it was, everybody knew old Dry Fry there. And they thought they'd killed him. And they got scared they'd be hung for murder because they had passed several people on the road who didn't know who was coming along there. Well, they took old Dry Fry and popped him up against a man's corn house. And that man, he went out early the next morning and he'd been missing corn. And when he seen this, there was someone over there at this corn house, he ran and got his gun, slipped around and hollered, get away from there or I'll shoot. And old Dry Fry never moved. He shot and Dry Fry turned over and hit the ground. Law me, said the man. I believe that was old Dry Fry. Everybody knew old Dry Fry. Now I've done killed him and I'll sure get hung for murder. So he went and saw it was him, seen how dead he was, and went to studying up some way to get rid of him. Well, he throwed him in the corn house to hide him, and that night he took the old Dry Fry down to a baptizer place, side of bend in the river where they were fixing to have a big baptizing the next day, propped him up on a stump on the riverbank, over a right deep place where the bank was pretty high. Propped his elbows on his knees and his chin on his hands, made him look awful natural, left him there, went on home and slept sound. So early the next morning, before anybody else, a little old feisty boy came down there fooling around the baptizing place, saw old Dry Fry, hollered, howdy, Mr. Dry Fry, went over closer. Howdy, Mr. Dry Fry. Old Dry Fry sat right on where he was. I said, howdy, Dry Fry. Old Dry Fry kept on sitting. The boy now, he was just as feisty as he could be. He didn't care how he spoke to nobody. Look here, old Dry Fry. If you don't answer me, howdy, I'm going to knock your elbows out from under you. Howdy, Mr. Dry Fry. So that feisty boy, he reached over and swiped old Dry Fry a click and over in the water, and an old man went right down the bank and into that deep water, sunk clean out of sight. Then the boy thought sure he'd drowned old Dry Fry. He got scared about being hung for murder, but he couldn't do nothing about it then because he'd seen folks coming down the road for the baptizing. So he hung around and directly everybody gathered for the baptizing. They waited and waited for old Dry Fry to come and preach, but he didn't come. And he didn't come. And when they got to asking who'd seen old Dry Fry, one man said he left his place right after supper. And another man said, why, no, he'd not seen Dry Fry since last meeting. And that feisty boy, he let out a giggle where he was sitting on one of the benches in the back. And the other boys asked him what he was laughing at. But he just get tickled again and not tell them nothing. So finally, the folks sung a few hymns and took up a collection. So meeting broke up and everybody went home and that boy, he went home too. Then way along, late that night, he went down and hooked old Dry Fry out of the river and put him in a sack. He got his shoulder under it, started down the road to hide him somewhere. Well, there were a couple of rogues coming along the same night, along the road that same night, had stole a couple of hogs and had them sacked up, carrying up on their shoulders. Them rogues came over a little rise in the road, saw that boy, and they got scared. They dropped their sacks and run back, lickety-split, and hid in the brush. The boy, he never saw the two rogues, so he came on, saw them two sacks, and set old Dry Fry down, see who was in the other sacks. Then he left old Dry Fry laying there, picked up one of the hogs, and went on back home. So the two rogues, they slipped out directly, and when they saw the two sacks still laying there, they picked them up and kept on going. They got in home and hung up the sacks out in that meat house. Then the next morning, the old woman got up to cook breakfast, went out to the smokehouse to cut some meat, ripped off one of them sacks, and there hung old Dry Fry. Well, she hollered and dropped her butcher knife, and she got away from there in such hurry that she tore down one side of the smokehouse, broke out two posts on the back porch, and knocked the kitchen door clean off the hinges. She was kind of scared. She hollered and squalled, and the men came running in their shirt tails and finally looked into the smokehouse, saw old Dry Fry hanging up there in the place of the hog. "Law of me," said one of them, "it's old Dry Fry." Everybody knew old Dry Fry. "We'll sure be hung for murder if we don't get shut of them, some way or other." Well, they had some wild horses in the wilderness out on the mountain. So they rounded up one of them, got him in the barn. Then they put on old no-count saddle on him and an old piece of bridle and put old Dry Fry on. Stropped his legs on the belly band, tied his hands to the saddle horn, pulled the reins through and stuck his old hat on his head. Then they slipped out and opened all the gates. They opened the barn door and let the horse go. He shot out of there and down the road he went with the old preacher man's bouncing first one side and then the other. Them tongues run out and went to shouting and howling. "He stole our horse. Stop him. Stop him. Somebody stop him. Yonder horse thief, horse thief." Everybody down the road come running out of the house shouting, hollering, shooting around. But that horse had done jumped the fence and looked up. Took up the mountain, and it looked like he was headed for Kentucky. And as far as I know, old Dry Fry is over there yet, tearing around through the wilderness on that wild horse. And that's the story of old Dry Fry. So good, you did laugh. All right. That makes me feel pretty.
It's a little gruesome.
I know. Isn't that something, though? But that is, you know, and that's one of those good old boy tales, you know. They got the body and they don't know what to do with it, so they do all kind of weird things, you know. I always wondered, what would you do if you can't, you know, you were in your house and you found a dead body? Just what would you do, especially if it wasn't one of your relatives, you know? I mean, if it was a relative, you'd know what to do. You'd call an undertaker or something and call the, you know, I guess you'd probably call 911 at first, but, you know, I mean, imagine opening your door and they're sitting in a chair is a dead body.
A stranger.
Yes. Yeah. You know.
But this was not a stranger in your story.
Oh, no, old Dry Fry. Everybody knows old Dry Fry. I mean, I can hear, I can just close my eyes and picture Jim May sitting in a chair in our house in Sharpsburg. Jim has been a guest in our house in Arkansas, Sharpsburg, in Marysville, Pennsylvania, Sharpsburg, Maryland. And it's, we were sitting in the living room. We were having a drink in the evening. And Jim has already done the storytelling workshop, and everybody had gone home. We were having a drink late in the evening, probably 10 o'clock or so. And he just leaned forward, and all of a sudden he said, "Have I ever told you the story of old Dry Fry?" And I just started laughing. And he said, "Apparently I have. Well, I'm going to tell you anyway, because I feel good tonight." And I still remember.
When you give Jim May a drink.
I remember, it was just, we had such a good time. We just laughed and laughed and laughed, you know.
I do love Jim May. He's a great storyteller.
Oh, he is great. You know, and he was a wonderful house guest. Each time he stayed at our house, and especially the last time when he was in Sharpsburg, I do remember that he just said, "Now tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up early and leave. So don't bother, worry about me. I don't need any coffee or anything. I'll stop on the road." And when I go to bed at night, sometimes I forget things. And I forgot that he had said that. And I heard a noise. Must have been 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. And the bedroom he stayed in was right next to our bedroom. And we were on the second floor of that house. And there was a bathroom right there, right next to our, you know, to those two bedrooms. And so I heard this noise in the hall, and I had forgot all about Jim being there, about him getting up early. I didn't know, you know, so.
You didn't shoot him, did you?
No, but I opened the bedroom door at the exact same time that he was coming out of the bathroom, and he and I both yelled at the same time, two older men in just their white skivvies, and we both laughed like we both got a little bit of a scare, and we both laughed like, "Oh, he said, you should go back to bed, I'm leaving."
Good old Jim May.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, here's my next. This is another column from Tim Rowland, who lived in Hagerstown, Maryland. I think initially he was born in West Virginia, but he lived in Hagerstown for years and years and years. And then he got tired of all of us here, and he kept his job with the newspaper, which is still called the Herald Mail, even though it's a USA Today affiliate at this point. But he now lives in Maine. What was your question?
The name of this paper?
The paper is the Herald Mail. It's the same Herald name Mail. It's always had. Okay. But it's been taken over by USA Today, so it's an affiliate of that company. Anyway, but Tim Rowland always makes me laugh. He lives in Maine, so I'm a little annoyed about that he left us. But this column is called "The Dog Days of Air Travel." If I've learned one thing this month, it's that if I'm a dog, I'm taking the bus. It's beyond me what makes it so hard for an airline to get canines from point A to point B without routing them through 27 different cities, sending them overseas by mistake, or suffocating them. There's been a spate of dog-related mishaps lately, each more bizarre or tragic than the last. Naturally, I hold the airlines accountable, although I would point out that what the dogs are suffering through is not materially different from what humans are asked to endure when taking to the friendly skies. The only reason a person hasn't suffocated yet is that stewardesses lack the physical strength to stuff passengers into an overhead bin. It's also true that dogs are generally better behaved than their human counterparts. Several weeks ago, a female passenger went ape, screaming over and over again, "I am God!" I don't know what that woman was up to, probably just trying to gin up another role for Meryl Streep. Dogs don't do that. You will never hear a dog proclaiming to be the Almighty trying to open the cabin door. Indeed, dog owners say it's inhuman to put animals in the cargo hold. But did anyone ask the dog? Maybe they prefer that to sitting next to the screaming God lady. Face it, flying is an awful experience for everyone these days. I blame People Express Airlines. Before the introduction of their low-cost fares, flying was either for business or a special occasion. It was expensive. People dressed up. I'm old enough to recall being borderline horrified and yet excited at the possibility when I saw someone wearing shorts on an aircraft. Family came to the airport to see you off like you were voyaging across the Atlantic on the Cunard Line. There was no shoving or being screamed at by frazzled, underpaid stewards. Pilots weren't glorified bus drivers. They were practically heroes with impressive salaries and status. If you were flying, you acted like D.B. Cooper. You buffed your shoes, put on a coat and tie, carried on your valise, stretched out your legs, and had the steward bring you a gin and tonic, perhaps two. Maybe you didn't jump out the back with $200,000 in cash at 20,000 feet, but other than that, this was the standard model. There were never any children because you left the children back home with Nanny where they belong, and there were certainly never any dogs. In the 1970s, you would take your dog to a funeral before you took him on a plane. People Express was the beginning of the end because it ushered in the gooberfication of air travel. From the mid-1980s on, you could glance across the aisle and see the guy from the double wide grinning at you. One hope. Never mind. Oof. From here, it was only one small step to bringing your dog. I love dogs, obviously. But don't you have to start drawing the line somewhere? What's next? People are going to start bringing their wash and hanging it to dry from a line between overhead compartments. But then you never read about dogs causing any problems, do you? It's the people. I don't fly anymore, partly because there's nowhere I really want to go, and partly because my legs no longer fit, but mainly because I don't want to be locked up with what feels like the entire cast of 6 months worth of Dr. Phil shows. Maybe if a new airline comes along called Dogs Express that occasionally allows a few well-behaved people, I will change my mind. He's sometimes mean, but he always makes me laugh.
Yeah, that's funny.
That was Tim Rowland, you know, in the Herald Mail newspaper out of Hagerstown, Maryland.
Hearing the remarks about the dogs being put into planes and everything reminded me in the early 90s, my oldest brother, who has since passed away, but then was not quite as bad health as he would be in years later, had a stroke. And I hadn't seen him in a number of years. So I decided to go to Michigan to see him. Now, I hadn't been on a plane in, I'd only had three plane rides in my whole life until then. Twice I flew from Germany in December of 1961 to go home on a 30-day leave. And that was 6 months before I was getting out of the Army. And then I flew back in January of 62. And then sometime in the 70s, that was on a Boeing 707 or some kind of airplane 707. Then in the 1970s, one of my best ever friends in teaching, Mr. Ricketts, had a World War II airplane, and it took him a couple years to convince me that I should go for a ride with him. And I went, and it was exciting. Grass airfield, short runway, ended with a steep drop, which was good because then we were in the air. flew over my house, flew far enough away from the school and the airport, his, what he called his airport. Actually had me have the controls a little bit a mile above my house. Since I was a track coach, he thought that would be appropriate. Anyway, in the 90s, I was going to fly to Michigan, and I was very apprehensive because it had been 20 years since I'd been in a plane, and none of those first three plane rides were satisfactory to me. So, and everybody was concerned. Are you sure you can be all right? You don't talk about flying, and you always worry about it. No, I'm gonna be fine. You know, I'm 50 some years old. I'm not gonna worry about flying. What the heck? It's safe and everything. Well, I had one of the worst days of my life because my stomach was upset, my bowels were upset, and I wound up vomiting in the bathroom of the airplane, which was a small bathroom in a small airplane. And it was one of the most miserable days of my life. And then I had to pretend when I got to my brother's place in Michigan, got a cab to his house, and got out of the cab, and he was waiting for me at the door. He was so happy to see his little brother. I had to pretend that it was nothing wrong, and that I had to make sure that I had my face turned away from him so that my bad breath wouldn't knock him over. And immediately after hugging him, went to the bathroom and used his toothbrush and his toothpaste and cleaned my mouth out real good. And I never did tell him about that occasion, but it was just a miserable, miserable flight. So it made me feel bad for the dogs in your story. So, this is a light and radio storytelling hour, and you've been listening to myself, Dosh Zielkowski, and
Fanny Crawford, myself.
Your storytelling hosts, ourselves. And this is lightningradio.org.
Okay, here's a really short story. There was once a man who promised his king he would teach a horse to talk. The man's friend said, "Are you out of your mind? He gave me a year." "I repeat, are you out of your mind? A year is a long time. The king could die. I could die. The horse could die. Or maybe the horse will talk."
That's
oh like my.
That's somebody who plays a long bet.
A true gambler.
Could you give me a time check, please?
I would be happy to give you a time check. See, I have 44 minutes.
Oh, okay. Well,
what do you have?
All right. I had roughly 40 minutes because I was a little slow, I think, in starting.
Okay.
But anyway, shall I do another story?
Yeah.
Okay, this is, I'm hoping this will be funny. And I guess we have enough time. Soap, soap, soap. One time there was a woman fixing to wash clothes and she found out she didn't have no soap. So she hollered for a little boy and told him, "Go to the store for soap." She says, "Don't you forget now, soap." So he headed for the store, running along and saying, "Soap, soap, soap," so he wouldn't forget. Came to a slick place in the road and he slipped and fell. Got up again, went on, tried to think of what it was his mommy had sent him for, and he couldn't remember. Let's see. So he walked back to where he slipped and says, "Right there, I had it." Walked on a few steps and said, "Right there, I lost it." Walked back. "Right there, I had it. Right there, I lost it." I kept on walking back and forth, and back. He had mud mired plumb over the top of his shoes. A man came along directly and heard what he was saying. And asked him, "What you lost?" "Right there, I had it. Right there, I lost it." "What did you look?" "I'll help you find it." "Right there, I had it. Right there, I lost it." So the man thought he was crazy and started on by, and he slipped on the boy's loblolly and fell to, and liked to fall. He said, "That blame mud, it's slick as soap." "Soap, soap, soap," the boy said, and started off again. And that man thought that the boy was mocking him, so he stepped over him, grabbed him, shook him, and said, "You say you're sorry, you won't do it again, or I'll whip you good." "Sorry I done it, won't do it again." "Sorry I done it, I won't do it again." So the man turned him loose and the boy ran on. But he started and saying that and couldn't think of the soap. Got down the road and came up across old woman and had fell in a ditch and broke all the eggs she had in the basket. She was getting up about the same time the boy came along. "Sorry I done it, won't do it again. Sorry I done it, won't do it again." The old woman thought she was making fun of her, so she grabbed him, boxed his ears. And then she pushed him in the ditch and says, "I'm out and you're in." And when he got out of the ditch and he went on saying, "I'm out and you're in, I'm out and you're in." Oh, come to where a man had one wagon wheel mired way down in a mud hole and was trying to get out. "I'm out and you're in, I'm out and you're in." The old man grabbed him and said, "You oughtn't say that. One's out and now you come here and help me get the other ones out or I'll whip you good." So the boy had to help him. When he got it out, on down the road he went. "One's out, got the other one out. One's out, get the other one out." And one-eyed man come along the road, and the boy went out past him and said, "One's out, got the other one out. One's out, get the other one out." So the old man grabbed him, and he just smoked that boy's britches. "You wouldn't say such a thing to me. You might have said, one's in anyway." Turned him loose, and the boy went on. One's in anyway. Come to where a woman was washing clothes on her washing place in the creek side of the road. Her two least young'uns was running around playing, and one of them had slipped and fell in the creek. The woman run to get it out, and just about the same time, there was that boy. One's in anyway. So she jerked the young man out of the creek, and then she went after that boy and grabbed him, and she was about to give him a good paddling for making fun of her and her young ones. But when she saw how dirty he was, he'd been in the mud so many times and been crying and wiping his face and his muddy hands, and she took pity on him, turned him loose. "You run on back home, turn mommy, take some soap and wash that black face." Then he heard soap. He lit out down the road. Soap, 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 soap. And that time he got to the store and got the soap and run on home with it, handing it to his mommy. And she gave him one look, and then she took him by the ear and marched him down to her wash place and soused him in the creek, clothes and all. Then she soaked him all over with his britches and his shirt right on him. Soused him again till she got all the mud and dirt off. Then she took two clothespins and hung him up on a clothesline by his shirt tail. Left him there to dry while she got the rest of her washing done. Another father came from before his kids while Sarah was in the midst of her story. Oh, never mind. I don't know where that came from. So the story ended with the woman left them there on the line. I don't know why I had a note down there at the bottom of that story, but anyway, that is a story. I remember once I told that a long time ago. I had worked on that and worked on it and worked on that, and I told that and I've only ever told that once, and it was at a small storytelling venue. People were enjoying it, and I got into it. It was one of those things. I'd worked on that story, and I don't know what kind of what kind of speech pattern or accent or what I was doing. But afterwards, I had a lot of compliments on being able to imitate the down-home kind of language that I was using. And I've always been worried that I could not duplicate that performance. And I don't think I did. But I do remember that people really appreciated it. And they thought that I had come from somewhere deep in the backwoods of Kentucky or something. And I assured them that it was just a fake.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna see if I can fit this story in. It's not very long. Or it's actually another Gene Weingarten column from July 24th, 2016 in the Washington Post magazine, which of course is long gone and I miss it. Oh. Gene Weingarten. And I'm reminded of this because I heard Jane Dorfman at the National Women's Storytelling Festival this weekend tell her story, her portray Calamity Jane. And one of the parts of that story is that Calamity Jane apparently had planned her last words on her deathbed because she wanted to be buried next to Wild Bill Hickok and Buffalo Bill Cody. She's very angry that people mix those two men up, and here I am mixing them up for her. Anyway, so this is dedicated to Jane Dorfman and Calamity Jane. From Gene Weingarten, a few weeks ago, I wrote about getting a solicitation from the AARP, a fine organization that makes you feel ancient and decrepit every time you hear from them. As always, it took me a few days to recover, but eventually I deluded myself back into thinking I am a rare specimen of middle-aged health, vitality, and vigor, which is exactly when I got the letter in the mail from a company trying to sell me a burial plot. The brochure from the Washington National Cemetery was bright and cheerful. Imagine the peace of mind from knowing it's all taken care of. And the letter included a stamped return reply envelope, which I used. I used it to mail back the brochure shredded into tiny pieces. I do understand that it might be financially prudent to plan for one's eternal rest, but this is one bit of prudence I will do without. That's because I subscribe to a fundamental fact of human psychology recognized a half century ago by a philosopher named Ernest Becker. One is able to enjoy life more or less exactly to the degree that one is able to deny death. It's not that you don't know it intellectually, that you're going to die. It's that you spend your time behaving as though you are not. It's about distracting yourself, benign self-deception. And it is why we avidly follow sports teams, drink beer to excess, and are drawn to religions that promise eternal life. If you are the sort of person who prudently arranges for your internment to the point that you are making regular quarterly payments toward the purchase of a specific coffin-sized hole in the ground that will someday contain your rotting corpse, you are not very good at the denial of death. You are Hamlet. You are Raskolnikov. You are a melancholic, the sort of person who compulsively reads obituaries to make sure you're not in them. I have found that denying death gets harder over time for obvious reasons I will not articulate here for obvious reasons. Many years ago, I wrote a humor book about hypochondria. On the flyleaf above my biography, there was a picture of me as a joke. Underneath it, I wrote, in parentheses, 1951 dash space end parens. At the time, I was 47 years old, and hinting at a death date seemed quite amusing. Now I'm 64. I have the book on a shelf, but I never take it down anymore. I've written in the past that if I can, I'm going to be sure my deathbed words will be, I should have spent more time at the office. I really do intend to do this for the lasting humor value of it, but of late I've been worrying whether I really will. I'm concerned that I might have a sudden attack of deathbed gravity syndrome and instead say something insipid like, all you need is love, or something phony poetic like, it is time for that sweet oblivion which awaits us all, or wildly overdramatic, like, exunt omnes, friends and lovers, I shall go it alone from here on. Maudlin, creepy deathbed fetishists advise you to continue speaking to your loved one even after he or she seems to have drifted away, because, quote, hearing is the last to go. I'm hoping that's wrong. I'm hoping the last sense to go is humor.
Well, just to reassure you, it's Wild Bill Hickok, not Buffalo Bill Cody.
Okay. Well, so I was right the first time, and I should have
left. Yes. And the only reason I know that is because Terry and I, one of our trips to the Dakotas, visited Deadwood.
All right.
And we went to the grave of Wild Bill Hickok. And I have seen Jane Dorfman do her Calamity Jane, and sometimes people do, and this is in no way a negative comment about anyone that we know and love dearly, but
be careful.
I just want to think if anybody would say that. But sometimes people imitate someone, and they're the wrong age or something. I remember a man coming to a school where I taught, at a private school where I taught, and the man was imitating, what was portraying Mozart. Now, you know, and I don't know a whole lot about musical history and stuff. I do know some things, but I do know that Mozart died as a young man. And Mozart was a great pianist. He was, you know, a child prodigy and all this stuff, and wrote beautiful music. But he died as a young man. In fact, I think he died in his 30s. You know, he never got to be an old man. This guy was 65 years old portraying Mozart. And he portrayed Mozart as a very young man. First of all, as a kid, and then as an 18-year-old. And I had the worst time. I mean, I closed my eyes and listened to him. And even then, I couldn't be convinced that he was a young man of any kind, because he spoke like, when I was doing things, I was like, he played the piano beautifully, but boy, he was definitely an old man. So he should have said he was like the ghost of Mozart or something, you know. Anyway. Well,
I will make sure to tell Jane Dorfman that she's old enough to play.
Well, I would not say enough. She's mature enough, and she portrays it well.
And apparently Calamity Jane only lived to be 45 or so.
Yeah, but I think she lived longer than that. Really?
No, I think not according to Jane Dorfman. But she and she was, you know, she had a hard life up until
she had a hard life, boy. There, I've seen pictures of her. Jane Dorfman makes Calamity Jane look like a beauty, you know.
And Jane Dorfman is a beauty.
I know, that's what I mean. Calamity Jane was no beauty. When I said one time I saw a real picture of Calamity Jane, and I thought, no wonder Wild Bill Hickok didn't write Calamity Jane.
He did. They were good friends.
I doubt that they were boy and girlfriends, because she was not an attractive lady.
Well, her last words were, bury me by Bill. And they did, even though all his friends told her beforehand that wasn't going to happen.
No.
I'm Fanny Crawford, and
I'm Stasi Okalski.
We've been your co-hosts for the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour today at enlightenedradio.org. We are independent community radio and broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown.
Recording stopped.
The Storytelling
Ignore
Hour
that.
Offers you, our listeners, yes, a window into the world of telling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for John Case coming up with
Roots. Roots music.
All right. Yeah.
That covers
this
a lot.
This was a good topic, Fanny, because you and I do laugh a lot.
I do. Yes, we do.